After the two muties disappeared, Ryan feared for the worst. Perhaps he and the others were nothing more than a curiosity, five incredibly stupid outlanders baking and dying in the heat. How long could they last out there in the Atlantic without food or drink? How long before they used their own weapons to ease the pain of the weaker ones? Ryan knew that land was close by. JB had used his mini-sextant and confirmed that the coast of Georgia was within their grasp. With the boost of an outboard engine, or a sail, or even paddles for the bastard raft they were currently calling home, the storm couldn't have taken them that far, of course. Suddenly, the raft shifted and began to lurch forward.
Hey, I take back every bad thought I've been thinking about the fishman and his wife. I think we're getting a lift.
Those muties must be strong as horses if they're going to try and push us all the way into shore. If that's what they're attempting to do.
Well, what else could it be? This isn't the easiest way to go about trying to sink us.
We heading in the right direction, JB?
I believe so. I'd have to do another reading to be sure, but land should be straight ahead.
What if they tear a hole in the raft?
He's got a point. Be easier to pull us with a rope.
The armorer took the coil he'd used back during the sinking of the patch to secure Ryan in his frantic and futile search for Christy and Jack. He lashed one end of the line to a hard plastic ring at the nose of the raft and dangled the other end down into the ocean.
Think they'll find it?
The answer came quickly as the rope went taut in JB's calloused hands.
Whoa!
The jerking stopped, and they began to make smoother progress. Time passed. About every half hour or so, the rope would slacken and the raft would slow and come to a stop. Then, in less than 10 minutes, after the muties had gotten their wind back, the trip would resume once more. All told, the journey took approximately 3 hours. The first thing Ryan and the others saw as they approached dry land was a windmill, rotating slowly from a perch high atop a mesh-like latticing of scavenged wood and metal. The fan blades of the windmill were painted a serene deep blue, much darker than the azure of the afternoon sky. As they came closer to the shore, more windmills were revealed to their line of sight, smaller ones joining the first, of all shapes and sizes. There were dozens of the rickety-looking support structures, each one with a bladed wheel on top, each wheel turning easily in the stiff breeze coming in from the sea. Some of the contraptions shared the same color of blue as the tallest one they had seen first. Others were painted in warmer colors, such as red and yellow. Amusingly enough, a few were adorned with a shocking coat of pink. A shambling maze of wooden steps led down into the massive windmills from a dock located at the water's edge. Ryan saw no other boats or seaworthy crafts. In fact, there was no transportation to be seen at all.
Ooh, bless my befuddled soul, but we are in Holland. Wooden shoes for everybody, I insist. Tulips of all hues for the taking. Once, tulips were as valuable as precious metals and fine gemstones. An entire economy built on the bulb of a flower, now lost, now common.
That isn't Holland, Doc. You're off by a few miles.
Woman, I am off more than a mere few miles. I am a full-blown mental mess. My mental state is off by distances that can only be measured between the stars.
I'm glad you said it and I didn't. I'd give anything for a tape recorder right now.
The steady forward momentum the two amphibian mutants had created as they pulled the raft along suddenly ceased, and the rope stretching into the water went slack for a final time.
Looks like the free ride's over.
Guess they didn't want a personal thank you.
Think we'll have to swim the rest of the way in, Dad?
Ryan was peering at the dock and the windmills.
No. We're still on a direct course with the dock. You see the ladder?
Ryan pointed at the lower front section of the dock.
Tide'll take us right to it, I hope.
Ryan was proved right. The yellow raft uncannily drifted into the proper position. Ryan and JB both reached out and grabbed the lower rung.
Like this balloon was remote controlled or something. Slid in just like a hot pipe.
Now that the raft was stable and they had a place to go, JB scanned the area as best he could before actually exiting into the unknown.
What's the drill? Our friend seemed to have pulled a vanishing act.
Not much choice in the matter, JB. We go ashore and see who's been building windmills. Mildred, see if you can get Doc to snap out of it long enough to use his hands and his feet. We're gonna have to climb out of here and get on dry land.
I'm not sure how much walking he's gonna be able to do once he's on the dock.
Mildred lifted one of Doc's rubbery arms and dropped it back down.
I'm not sure how much more I'm going to be able to take myself. We're all as weak as newborns.
Not me. I feel great. Hungry as a two-headed muty tiger, but I feel good. I'm ready to do some exploring.
Sure, Dean. I'm feeling the adrenaline surge, too. We found a safe harbor, but once we get up on that dock, I doubt we're going to be able to do much of anything beyond a measured crawl.
Ryan reached out, taking a rung of the wooden ladder and pulling himself upright. Ryan was the first man out of the raft, his gun in hand.
Come on, Doc. Rise and shine.
Are we there yet?
Dean spotted a trench with running water as soon as they stepped off the dock and onto the grassy beachlands where the windmills were standing.
Hot damn water!
Hold up before you go drinking, Dean. Odds are these windmills are pumping some kind of seawater.
JB cupped a handful to his nostrils.
Yeah, this is salty. At least it smells salty. Of course, everything smells salty to me after being out in that raft as long as we were.
Looks like a settlement over there.
Mildred pointed toward a group of tents and other structures in the near distance. No one there had noticed the visitors yet, or if they had, they weren't too excited about it. The architecture of the settlement was non-existent. Most of the shelters that came into view as Ryan and the others warily approached were indeed nothing more than old tents. There was a handful of recycled travel trailers and a broken-down motorhome that was more rust than metal. A large circus tent with a high ceiling and faded strips of red and yellow stood near the center of the misshapen community. Picnic tables of wood were scattered in front of the tent and by a natural well, which appeared to serve as the source for fresh drinking water and bathing, since three old white porcelain bathtubs with the plugs permanently adhered into their drains were behind a portable curtain. Most of the people seemed to be dressed in similar loose-fitting jumpsuits.
What kind of a vill is this?
Not a vill. It's a commune. What you see is what you get, so don't go shooting off those blasters or trying to push people around. Mind your business like everyone else is doing. You're welcome to stay.
A commune, you say? So, where are the flowers in your hair, madam?
Haven't worn flowers in years, but it's a nice sentiment. I'm Shauna Watson. I run the place, such as it is.
Ryan Carter. This here's my boy, Dean. The older man is Doc Tanner. J.B. Dix is on his right. The lady's Dr. Mildred Wyeth.
Shauna Watson looked to be about 40 years old. Her thick black hair was cut painfully short to the scalp. Blue eyes, the same color as the blades of the windmill the companions had first seen, were set in a tanned face. Freckles dotted the bridge of her pug nose. She'd been cute once. That much could be seen. Now, approaching middle age had given her an elfin gamine quality that she'd carry to her grave. Like the others in her commune, she was wearing a one-piece khaki jumpsuit with a zipper running down the length of the front from throat to crotch. The zipper was open down to the navel, leaving little to the imagination regarding her small yet still firm breasts. The sleeves of her functional attire were rolled up high on her upper arms, revealing veined biceps. Shauna wasn't a woman used to sitting back and letting others do the work. Knee-high boots with a flat heel and a wide utility-type work belt completed the ensemble.
Two doctors. We could use a physician.
Only one to choose from, I'm afraid. I am a doctor of letters. My colleague is the general practitioner.
Got a little girl broke her arm just yesterday. I've tried to set up a temporary splint, but I'm no medic. Would you mind?
Not at all. But I've got to get some kind of nourishment in my stomach. The shape I'm in right now, I wouldn't be much help to anybody.
Fair enough. We can get together some food while your party washes up.
Shauna's gaze fell to the holster of Ryan's Sig Sauer, as well as the other hardware the group was carrying.
What is the story behind the blasters? You and your group are packing enough heat to burn down my entire place here without even emptying the clips.
Protection. The only man without a blaster these days is a dead one.
You freelancing for Poseidon? Doing merc work?
No. We don't even know who Poseidon is.
One of the men, when we first obtained our vessel, mentioned a Lord Poseidon. They mockingly called themselves disciples.
Calling himself a lord now, is he? Guess it's as good a title as any. Yeah. Lord Poseidon is a real piece of work, showing up here all the time and bleeding us dry. Bastard. No naval vessels can enter this part of the coast without his say-so.
We did.
And then you found out the hard way about his paranoid little piece of the world. The Admiral doesn't like surprises. He's the one who blew your boat out from under you.
He's the one who caused the accident?
Unless you had a chart of the location of the mines.
Ryan felt like he'd just been knifed in the stomach and gutted up to his chin. The mine that had wrecked the patch had a source, and the source's name was Poseidon. Ryan's hand shot out and grabbed Shauna by the upper arm, pulling her close to him.
I have a debt to settle with your admiral.
Don't we all?
The group turned and saw not a person, but the twin barrels of a shotgun sticking out of a window flap.
Let the lady go, One Eye, and we'll give you all the dope you need to know about Poseidon. Believe me, we don't exactly care for the son of a bitch either.
How did you know about a boat?
Mike told me. Mike and Ida.
Mike and Ida? What kind of stoop names are those?
Mike and Ida are what we call the two dwellers who saved your ass, boy. You've seen them, so you know they're muties. Far as I can tell, Mike must have heard the explosion. Maybe he was even out that way when it happened. He's the one who found you. Came back and discussed it with his people. They sent him to me, and we were all in agreement to bring you in.
Ryan tamped down his rage and released his grip on Shauna's arm. She rubbed her upper arm vigorously to return the circulation. Ryan's fingers had clamped down like steel bands.
Now, I'm letting all of you keep your blasters, just to show we can trust one another. Here at the commune, our day-to-day survival depends on our word.
My word's good. You'll have no trouble from us.
You speak for the ones with you?
I do.
I'm coming out, then.
A tall, lean man with long blonde hair and brown eyes stepped from hiding. For a change, he wasn't wearing one of the jumpsuits. He wasn't wearing much of anything at all but a pair of oft-repaired cut-off blue jeans and a worn pair of sandals. Besides staying cool in the heat, the reason for his lack of clothing was undoubtedly to maintain a rich brown tan and to show off the ornate tattooing that covered his entire body. The shotgun was still leveled at the group.
Name's Alan Carter. I heard who you are. I'm sec man for the commune.
Real trusting for a sec man, aren't you?
Not really. But you said the magic word when you mentioned Poseidon. I, for one, would like to see him dead. And any enemy of his is a friend of mine.
Ryan took in the pattern of tattoos that wrapped around Carter's chest, back, neck, arms, and legs. The canvas his body had provided was a work of skin art. The subject seemed to be a mix of demons and machinery. Skeletons with blazing skulls atop roaring motorcycles, green-faced monsters with Popeyes and fangs, their tongues lolling out long and wet behind them as they shifted gears with floor-clutch rigs as big as their freakish heads. Even horned devils atop rocket ships, weaving their pitchforks as they blasted off into the great beyond.
Nightmarish. How do you sleep at night?
By closing my eyes.
About the accident. Were there any casualties?
Two. A man and a woman. Jack Lauren and Christy Roth. I don't suppose your Mike found any more survivors?
No, he didn't.
That'd be pretty hard to miss. Jack's a full albino, and Christy's got the reddest hair this side of a sunset.
Sorry, Cardor, but no. You and your buds are it.
Maybe another one of his muty friends?
No bodies, no trace, nothing.
Take a moment to wash up. I'll get supper going earlier than usual in your honor. After you're done, come inside the big tent here. Obviously, we need to talk.
Funny. I still feel wrong speaking of them in the past tense. I can't think of them as being dead. Not yet.
The rest of his friends, minus Mildred, who was checking the injured child, and Alan Carter and Shauna Watson, were seated at various places along the numerous tables inside the tent. Normally, this was the community dining room, but it also served as a place for meetings. A meal was being prepared at the back of the tent while they talked.
Before, Christie's death seemed to be fate spinning down on my head again. Now I've got a face and a name to put on who took her from me.
Poseidon's been responsible for a lot of deaths, Cawdor. How far are you intending to take this?
As far as it goes.
Good.
Why were you here? We don't get many sea travelers.
We were looking to head up the coast. Head for the Carolinas. Virginia, maybe. Too damned hot down here. No real agenda.
I'd like to know more about these mutants.
Mildred had overheard the end of the conversation and was casually trying to change the subject from Ryan's lust for revenge on Poseidon.
Have they always been here?
As long as I can remember, Dr. Wyeth. But we don't know where the poor bastards were originally spawned. There are old stories about a colony of test subjects housed in an old oil rig located far offshore. Scientists were living there while trying to create a new race of muti. The dwellers seem to be the result.
So, how many of them are there?
About a dozen adults, a few kids. Most of the young are stillborn. Because of the high death rate, they treasure their children above all else. We never actually get to see the children. Except for me and a few others in the commune here. Dwellers tend to shun contact with landers.
Can't blame them for that.
We have a trade deal with them. Similar to the one we have to maintain with Poseidon. Except the mutants are much more fair and humane. No surprise there.
They do talk, then. Ryan said he heard one of them speak to him.
Right.
Speech isn't very comfortable for them, especially English. The only reason Mike can talk as well as he does is because it's a carryover from his former humanity. They prefer to communicate in wordless ways, their eyes, facial expressions, you know, body language.
Tell me the pattern. What's the usual way you go about trading?
Once a day at sunset, we go and trade. What we have to offer is minuscule compared to the amount of seafood they bring us, but I think they like having us as neighbors, so they never complain.
No, no, not the muties. I'm talking about Poseidon.
Once a week, now that it's getting warmer. He should be sending a wagon to pick up his tribute in the next day or two. Why?
Might have an idea. I'll let you know when.
Actually, before he got his navy fetish, Poseidon was rumored to be involved with a project that created the Dwellers. Of course, he couldn't have been more than a kid. I doubt he was the one actually doing the genetic engineering. Probably his old man or another relative.
We have a lot in common with the Muties. We all want to be left alone, to live our own lives. Simple as that. For them, Poseidon and his fleet aren't much of a threat. But for us, as long as he continues to show up demanding tribute for his so-called protection of our waterways, we can never hope to be safe.
The truth lies in the name.
Damn it, Doc. You need to be resting.
I am resting, my good woman. I cannot remember a time in recent memory when I was more at ease. There's dry land beneath my boot heels. The sky is sunny and warm, without a hint of rain. I am dry and relatively clean. Life, for the immediate moment, is good.
Go ahead, Doc. I recognize the look in your eye. You've got something to tell us. But try and keep it short. None of us are in the mood to be lectured at.
Very well, Dr. Wyeth. As I was saying, the truth behind our unseen foe lies in the name he has chosen for himself. For one who has his origins in the sea and continues to attempt to dominate his own little kingdom, the name of Poseidon is an inspired selection.
How so?
Greek mythology, sir. The timeless tales of the ancient gods and the human heroes who tried vainly to live up to the examples set by their masters. Unfortunately for all of humanity, the gods, too, were as flawed as their human creations.
Always wondered why everything was so screwed up.
Poseidon was lord of the sea, and friend enough to man to present him with the first equine.
First what?
First horse. Try and keep the florid speech patterns down to a level where we can all understand it. Okay, Doc?
Of course, of course. Now, where was I? Oh, yes. Poseidon was also brother to the mighty Zeus, the supreme ruler of all, and second only to him in eminence. Zeus was the Stormbringer, ruler of the sky and master of the terrible thunderbolt. Poseidon's domain was nearly as great. His domain was the sea, and when he was not inhabiting the halls of Grand Olympus with his brothers, Poseidon could be found below the waves in a magnificent palace of his own design.
Sounds like the Admiral. He's always on or near or under the water somehow.
Like Zeus, Poseidon was also a master of the storm, but only those at sea. He carried a mighty trident, a three-pronged spear, with which he would shake and shatter whatever he pleased. In fact, Poseidon was commonly called Earthshaker.
Lesson's over. The way they're waving him back, food's ready.
The dinner bell served to summon all to dinner. The other members of the commune, which seemed to consist of less than 100 total, were mostly women with a small mix of children, ranging from 8 to about Dean's age. A few elderly folk were also in the count Ryan silently made. He noted the lack of men of any age. All of them were starting to mill about and take seats at the wooden picnic tables in the tent.
We'll all eat, and you can enjoy tonight's entertainment. We'll talk more tomorrow. For now, you're our guests.
The meal that was being laid out before them was the first real solid nutrition any of the travelers had eaten since the visit to Tucky's. The feast began with the placement of a single tall plastic tumbler on the table at the hand of each diner. After the glasses were down, two women in the familiar jumpsuits walked down either side of the aisles with carts that bore large clear pitchers filled with an icy cold brown liquid. The cold was apparent, since drops of condensation were beading the pitchers' exteriors. Each cup was filled to the top with the liquid, and the remainder of the pitcher left at the table. Mildred and Doc, recognizing the beverage, both responded by grabbing the plastic glasses and taking generous gulps.
By the three Kennedys!
Oh, iced tea.
The rest of Ryan's party followed suit, drinking greedily.
We believe in maintaining some of the old southern traditions down here.
Where'd you get the ice? You got a generator for a freezer?
Of a sort. We harvest wind power for irrigation and electricity. We have a shed with electric lights and some outlets to run refrigerators and freezers for storage.
As the tea was being consumed, simple fresh salads came around. In the huge bowls plopped down at each table were lettuce, chopped celery, sliced radishes, onions, tomato wedges, strips of green pepper, and a few bits of cucumber. An oil and vinegar dressing was also presented in small glass bottles. Dean was the only holdout who passed on filling his plate from the bowl, but everyone else happily partook of the chance for real fresh vegetables instead of something dried or in a can. After the salads, ceramic bowls of a pasty cornmeal soup with chicken broth were given to the diners. The soup was a filling and tasty appetizer that everyone lapped up. After the soup was gone, the table was presented with a platter of white fish and tomato sauce, with finely chopped onion, garlic, parsley, and sea kelp. The many natural additives gave the fish a spicy flavor.
This reminds me of my auntie's good old southern cooking.
All of the food is grown on the commune, and the spices you're tasting is undoubtedly from the fresh hot chili pepper that's been minced and added to the sauce for an extra kick, along with just a smidgen of oregano.
You speak with authority, madam. Sounds as though you know your way around the kitchen.
This is my recipe. And we have a few here who fancy themselves as chefs.
You may present them with my highest compliments. They have paid ample tender in the past for food from restaurants that claimed to be eateries that were not even close to the flavor of this repast.
That means he likes it.
The fish beneath the sauce was boneless, fine, and flaky, and the many pounds brought out quickly disappeared. The leftover tomato sauce was scooped up with chunks of coarse cornbread, torn in hunks from round loaves. The bread tasted gritty, with hints of honey and molasses, and washed down easily with more of the sweetened iced tea. For dessert, metal trays of steaming peach cobbler were brought out and dished up. Extra helpings would have been taken without hesitation, but the cobbler was such a hit that there was barely enough to go around.
Most scrumptious.
No one could have put it better. When the tables were cleared, as promised, there was entertainment. Ryan begged off, citing lack of sleep and exhaustion, when all those close to him knew it was because he was still grieving for Christy. They shared his grief while respecting his privacy. Ryan would socialize more with their benefactors, as well as his comrades, when he was ready. Grateful to their rescuers, the rest of the group accepted the invitation and soon joined dozens of other members of the commune on blankets around a central elevated platform. The platform had a half roof for protection and used the natural amphitheater provided by an upthrust mass of rock. The companions were expecting live talent, perhaps a singer or a band with simple string instruments, or even some sort of theatrical play with actors reciting poetry or scripted words while treading the boards of a makeshift stage. From what they had seen, the commune seemed to be as low-tech as one might expect, with oil lamps and torches for light and open fires for cooking.
Oh, I hope it's not a storyteller. I hate those long-winded stoops.
Oral traditions have been a part of mankind since he first learned to stand upright, John Barrymore. Before the advent of written language, the telling of stories was the only way of preserving culture from generation to generation.
Sounds more like tall tales and heaping mounds of crap to me. Truth tends to get distorted in the telling.
True enough, but hopefully they become entertaining as well.
Ooh. Well, I'll be damned. An honest-to-God boombox.
Looks like a comm device to me. A big one.
It's a radio, all right, John, but only a receiver. No two-way communication. You can't use it to broadcast, only to pick up open signals sent across the airwaves.
I know what a radio is, Millie. I just never saw one like that before.
Shauna had brought out a rectangular black monstrosity that was approximately 4 feet long and 3 feet high. Most of the radio was taken up by speaker capacity, with two large grid-covered sections on either end and two smaller speakers in the upper corners. The front was slotted for the playing and recording of cassette tapes, while on top of the device was a concave indentation with a flip-top door where compact discs could be inserted. Various silver buttons lined the radio's front center section beneath the door for the cassette player. On one end was a huge black knob, and on the other a knob of equal size but colored white. The device was topped off with a slender silver antenna, which Shauna pulled up to full extension. Carter stepped up next to her, holding an old automotive battery with a mess of retrofitting and rigging along the top terminals. A single wire with a female receiving plug head at the end came from the mass of wiring. Carter plugged this into a three-prong male plug coming from the back of the box, glanced at Shauna, and nodded affirmative, as the lights and dials on the front of the radio lit up in a faint mix of amber and green.
You can say what you want about our neighbor, but Poseidon has great taste in music.
Carter turned the largest dial. One after another, the songs of the past played without stop, echoing out over the pocket of humanity clinging to life among the ruins of the dead Earth.
What's wrong, Millie?
No chatter, no advertising, nothing but music. It took us until the millennium and the end of the world to get rid of Madison Avenue, but by God, it might have been a fair trade. One civilization in exchange for some peace and quiet. If only we'd been able to keep from blowing up most of the planet in the process.
The group of friends sat quietly after that, listening to the music play long into the night. Morning brought yet another vibrant sunny day. Dean awakened alone. He got up from the mattress and walked outside. He spotted an older Hispanic woman from the night before and waved. She waved back, then gestured for Dean to approach.
Morning! Did you enjoy the entertainment?
Sure did. I even liked the slower songs.
Good, good. I have a boy about your age. I'll introduce you to him after he has done his chores.
Okay. Any idea where my dad is?
Probably having breakfast. Of course, it is getting late.
Thanks. I could use some breakfast myself, but I think I'll wash my face first.
The young man stepped over to the communal well and brought up a bucket of clear, cold water, pouring it into a freestanding scavenged sink near the tubs. Dean poured a ladleful over his head and then slicked his hair back with a small black pocket comb. Looking at himself in a broken scrap of mirror hanging on the pole where the sink was mounted, Dean decided he looked presentable enough and headed for the main tent. Then he saw the inhuman shadow loom up from behind him. Dean dropped into a fighter stance, ready to do battle. Standing before him, at 7 feet tall and with a quizzical expression, was a dweller. Dean could tell from the shape of the face and the eyes that this wasn't the same Muti that had assisted the companions yesterday. Boy and Muti stared at each other.
Morning, Carl.
The dweller slowly raised a hand in greeting to the woman.
He won't hurt you, Dean.
You're welcome to the sink. I was just finishing up.
Dean didn't look back as he walked fast into the large communal tent with the picnic tables where he dined the evening before. There were a few of the commune members inside. At a rear table by himself with a platter of leftover white fish, fried potatoes, and scrambled eggs was Doc.
The sun always rises. And so does youth, eventually.
How's it hanging, Doc?
Dean sat down across from the old man.
By a thread, dear boy. I fear it may soon drop off altogether.
Where is everybody?
On a scouting mission. Your father wishes to learn more about Admiral Poseidon. I believe he intends to challenge him over the unfortunate deaths of Christy and Jack.
Damn straight.
Beware the enticement of revenge, Dean.
Eye for an eye, Doc. This Poseidon had it coming.
Perhaps.
Why didn't he take me?
Well, it was decided to let you sleep in. I promised to tell you what was going on when you awakened. Frankly, I did not feel much like getting up myself. My mind is back, but my body is still lacking.
Mind sharing?
Not at all. Dig in.
And Dean did.
I gotta tell you, Doc, I like eating fish better than talking to him.
Oh, you have met Carl. He's quite the conversationalist.
No, but he makes up for it in odor. Those dweller guys stink.
They are part fish, young Carter. What do you expect? Their scent was like pure ambrosia when they showed up at our raft.
There's a man with a well-trained nose.
Shauna had just stepped under the protective awning and into the tent in time to hear the end of the conversation.
You two didn't want to go with the others?
I did, but they wouldn't let me.
And I am still weary from our sea voyage. Let the others scheme and plot this morning. I shall sup from this bountiful breakfast until I've had my fill, and then I plan to return to my deep slumber.
That's fine. By the way, Ryan Jr.
Name's Dean.
I'd watch my words around here when commenting on the dwellers. They're might sensitive about having their Muti traits so baldly pointed out, especially from a runt like you. They can't help being what they are. Now, you might be...
I call him as I see him. Or smell him.
Shauna's right hand shot up like it was spring-propelled. Her steely fingers grabbed Dean by the earlobe and squeezed.
Interrupt me again, and I'll toss you off the nearest dock myself. Didn't your daddy teach you anything about manners?
Lady, if you don't let go of me, my dad will slice you into so many pieces, your fishy friends won't be able to find enough left to use as cut bait!
He'll have to chill me first, Junior, and you'll still be dead.
As I recall, madam, the boy's father was discussing that very same subject a few weeks back.
What? About being chilled?
Shauna twisted Dean's ear again to emphasize her point.
Ow!
No, about manners. Dean is young, a mere slip of a man, just on the cusp of his teenage years. I assure you, he means no disrespect to you, our hosts, or to the unfortunate dwellers. The boy has lost a woman he loved as a mother, and a longtime friend in the span of one stormy night. Any words out of his mouth right now are to be viewed as suspect. I suggest he's transposing his own anger at their perishing and his emotional anguish into aggression at yourself.
Shauna pondered that, still keeping a white-knuckled grip on Dean's aching ear.
You make good sense, Tanner. You said you were a doctor, but not a med guy. What, you a head shrinker or something?
I? My degree is in philosophy, my dear. And in philosophy, men have found answers to the questions that have plagued them for thousands of years. My wisdom comes from the words and teachings of the ancients, along with a healthy dose of education I've been exposed to while traversing these so quaintly and so accurately named Deathlands.
Shauna released her grip on Dean's earlobe. The boy slumped in his chair sullenly, rubbing the sore spot where her fingers had twisted the sensitive cartilage. His skinny arms crossed in over his chest in an unconscious protective position.
Okay, Dr. Tanner. We'll let this one go. I haven't had to deal personally with a boy child in a long time, and I've forgotten how mouthy they can be. I'm still hoping we can convince your group to hang with us. We need warriors if we're ever going to get out from under Admiral Poseidon's thumb. I won't speak of it to Cawdor if you won't.
My lips are sealed. As for Dean's...
Doc says nothing happened. I say nothing happened.
Damn! But you are your father's son.
Thanks for the assist, Doc. My ear feels like she twisted it plumb off my skull.
There was never any reason for you to fear, young Cawdor.
Suddenly, like a razor-edged jack-in-the-box, the cutting blade hidden within Doc's walking stick sprang out from a secure and hidden place beneath the table.
Had she continued to press the issue, I would have been forced to sever her offending appendage at the wrist.
Doc returned the blade to its proper place and dropped his sword stick back into his lap.
Now... Be a good boy, and please pass that bowl of potatoes. I must address my starch deficiency.
Ryan looked down at the colors of the coastline below him, the vibrant hues of the ocean, and the dusky tones of the land, dotted with sporadic growth of forest and upheavals of rock. And he knew in the bottom of his soul that any other time, he would have allowed himself to enjoy the sight. This part of Georgia seemed to have escaped the utter devastation other sections of the United States had endured. Christy would have liked it. She liked any natural spot that was unblemished. At his side were JB and Mildred, along with their long-haired guide, Alan Carter. They all stood at the top of a 100-foot observation tower, built of wood and metal.
There's two ways they can come. One by land, one by sea. If they cruise up in one of his yachts, we know Poseidon himself is aboard. Supposedly, he rarely steps on dry land. Prefers to feel the ocean beneath his feet. We joke he's part dweller.
Maybe he is.
However, he hasn't done a personal appearance in a long time. Too busy, I guess. If there's no boats on the horizon and a land wag pulls in, like the pattern for the last few months, we can totally discount the Admiral's presence. He's not as inclined to show off anymore. He just wants his men to pick up his offerings and bring him back to base.
50-50 odds.
Either way, we can take the bastard out. One method just takes a little longer, that's all. Doesn't matter much to me. I've got all the time in the world now.
Got a plan?
Yeah.
JB wasn't convinced, but the armorer took the intonation of Ryan's voice and the loss he'd endured into consideration. What kind of plan was needed, really, beyond the healing power of playing Avenger? He thought about asking Ryan to elaborate on the plan, then thought the better of it. His friend would explain what scheme he had in mind when ready.
So we know where they'll be coming from now. How about we discuss our next move down on the ground, where it's safer?
Don't you worry none, Dr. Wyeth. This Tyra might seem shaky, but she's here to stay. We check her out on a regular basis. Being so close to salt water and all, we have to.
When do they come? How often?
Usually mid-morning, before noon. Comes once a month during winter months, but during summer and early fall they show up once a week. Maybe 10 days. There's no real accurate way to predict it. Since he tends to spoil meat faster, he'll be sending men out, or coming himself within a hand of days, I'd say. The good admiral prefers to see food fresh. Likes it raw, from what I hear.
Likes sushi, does he?
I'm sure he does, Doctor. He seems to enjoy everything else.
Can you keep a lookout up here during the day?
Why?
I need to know exactly when this Poseidon is going to arrive. Even a warning of a few minutes is better than nothing.
Shouldn't be a problem. I'll discuss it with Shauna.
Nothing to discuss. Here's the plan. If Poseidon floats in by sea, we go on board his ship and take him out. Face to face, no mercy. If he sends a gathering party in by land, we take them out and ride back in style to his base, where again, we meet him face to face and chill him. Either way, we win. Simple as that.
Overhead, the night sky was crystal clear, revealing the facets of each and every star. Evidence of past storms and conflict had once again vanished in a space of days. Ryan was sitting alone in a naturally created nook near the rocks and sand of the beach, at the far edge of the primary encampment of the commune, when Shauna approached him with a covered plate of hot food and a battered bottle of tea. His back was to her, so she tried stepping lightly to keep from startling him. No go. He heard her in time to whirl around with his gun. He pointed the weapon directly on a sight between her eyes and wordlessly waggled the barrel of the Sig Sauer.
Hello to you too, Cawdor.
Take the hint.
Missed you at dinner.
Wasn't hungry.
Bullshit. You're hurting and didn't feel up to conversation. I know the signs.
Ryan turned and stared at her. To her credit, she stared right back.
You'd make a hell of a great pirate, Cawdor. You already have the look.
I don't get you. Shauna pointed at his eye patch.
Required garb for any self-respecting pirate.
Right. As I recall, pirates were also supposed to have hooks for hands and wooden pegs for legs, and a talking bird on their shoulder. No wonder the poor gimps had to steal. They were crippled and half blind.
Your friends said not to bother you.
My friends were right.
Well, I'm not having my key ally going to bed with his belly empty the night before a fight. I can hold my anger close just as well on a full stomach.
I thought you said Poseidon may not show.
He may not. Still, why take chances? Your plan is workable, and I've been wanting to bring down that bastard for a long time.
Why do you stay here?
Why not? Climate's good, plenty to eat. People who care for me live here. I could do worse.
What, with this admiral you have to bow down and pay tribute to? That kind of extortion shit gets old triple fast.
Sometimes. Sometimes, Cawdor, it's easier than trying to fight back. You have to remember, when the admiral first approached us about trading, we were on a more equal footing. I had more men at the commune. Good sec men. A couple of years pass, and then suddenly he's got the advantage. Some of our people go missing, or have accidents. Or worse yet, join his outfit.
Ryan turned and looked at her profile in the moonlight. He knew from the pain etched in her face that she was telling the truth when she had told him she knew the signs of hurting.
What did Poseidon do to you? Besides bleeding off your commune, I mean.
Not my commune. Our commune. Belongs to all of us, even you, if you want to stay.
Shauna sat down next to Ryan.
The good admiral says he's a businessman. Once he gained the advantage, he came in here and started telling us how things were now going to be. My husband didn't agree. Poseidon invited him and a hand-picked squad to travel back to King's Point for a summit meeting. I never saw my husband alive after that.
Fire blast.
I was ready to go after Eric and see Poseidon's head on a post, but I didn't have enough fighting men to support an assault. Poseidon made a point of not coming back around here in person after that. He might have been frightened, or cautious, or both. I don't know. I kept telling myself that Poseidon was a military sect type, not a fisherman or a farmer. The folks here were more in tune with a band of underwater muties, peace and love and harmony with nature. Leave us alone, we leave you alone.
The pain never left, did it?
I'm as ready for vengeance now as I ever was. I lost my man 3 years ago, Cawdor. He was a lot like you, stubborn and pig-headed. I heard the admiral beat him to death with a whip in a public flogging as a lesson, as a good old-fashioned example. I'm constantly amazed at how reverting back to the old ways for most seems to entail brutality.
Human nature.
Shauna leaned over and kissed the one-eyed man gently on the lips. Mm. Ryan didn't refuse, nor encourage the gesture of intimacy.
It's been over 3 years for me, Ryan.
Shauna, I can't make love with you. The timing's all wrong for now.
I figured as much. I just thought you could use some company, that's all. You're a leader, I'm a leader. Leaders can't let themselves show weakness in front of their followers, no matter how close they are as friends or family. Part of the territory, right?
Part of the territory.
The wag rolled into Shauna's territory at approximately 20 minutes after 12. High noon, and the sky overhead was crisp and clear. So clear that objects as far away as 100 feet still looked as sharp as if they were directly in front of your nose. The air was silent, precisely so, as if waiting in anticipation for the inevitable sudden sound or motion to appear in a rapid onrush to shatter the serenity. The young lookout in the watchtower, flat on her stomach to avoid detection, had spotted the transport well in advance of its arrival. She had signaled the waiting group below with a prearranged motion that the convoy consisted of a single vehicle, just as had been predicted. After the high sign had been given, there was nothing to do but wait. As they took their positions in the trench alongside the dirt and gravel roadway, a trench that had been widened and deepened to accommodate the lean and lethal attack force, Ryan had to wonder if such a simple plan of battle would work.
Simple, sometimes the best way.
JB waited with Ryan in the ditch alongside the roadway. His eyes wandered over enviously to the ordnance Shauna and Carter were carrying. Earlier, Carter had led JB and Mildred to a secure place hidden away in a seaside cavern about a quarter mile from the cluster of shacks and tents that made up the commune. From a grease-stained canvas bag, Carter had pulled out twin calico M955 AS light submachine guns, complete with full shoulder butts and forward hand grips, all molded in stark black metal and plastic. The calico was a unique little weapon that was a cross between a machine pistol and a full-blown rifle.
PDWs.
The cave was a natural formation fortified with large wooden beams, jammed every few feet along the walls in a basic yet effective effort to prop up the ceiling and avoid the possibility of having the roof fall down around a visitor's ears.
PD what?
PDWs, quick speak for personal defense weapons. They emerged in the pre-dark days right before the nuke cost for non-soldier types to use. You know, white coats, engineers, comm men, techies, drivers. Those guns you have there were made by Coleco Incorporated of Bakersfield, USA. First appeared in 1989 by the old calendar.
Carter glanced at Mildred with a cocked eyebrow.
One thing John knows is guns, Carter. He's probably the greatest weapons expert left alive in Deathlands.
Do tell. I'm smart enough to know these are good guns, but I didn't plan on being quizzed.
Now, the Coleco is a modular system which allows a longer or a shorter weapon to be assembled from interchangeable components. You've got the full package there. Best of all is the Coleco's amazing large magazine capacity. A small mag holds 50 rounds, a large one 100. You can always tell a Coleco magazine by the shape of the mag.
Really? And why is that?
Coleco is the only PDW to use a cylinder mag. Either the large or the small will clip down right on top of the gun, storing the cartridges in two helical layers. Ammo feed comes down from the top, while the spent cartridges eject underneath instead of out the side. Sweet little guns.
Glad you approve. These are in good shape, but unfortunately, what you pointed out about the ammo is true. We got a 100-shot load and a 50-shot and a backup 50. And that's it. Most of the better stuff was lost the first time a group of us took Poseidon on.
What else you got?
In guns? Not much.
Carter took another of the insulated sacks and revealed the remaining stockpile of hardware. JB eyed the rest of the weapons dump. Carter wasn't understating the loss. A few six-shot Colt revolvers, a rifle that looked as though it was an antique when Doc was still young, and an astonishing lack of ammunition.
Might as well toss these in the ocean.
Don't believe in that around here, Dix. Guns don't belong in the sea.
Anything else? Some plastique? We're going to need it to go through with the plan.
Doctor, I wouldn't have brought you all the way out here if I didn't have more.
Carter flipped up a blanket, revealing a green crate he'd been sitting on.
Besides the calicos, my private stash has one other distinct advantage going for it.
Hidden away inside the big rectangular metal storage container, painted olive green, was the advantage. Thick white letters and numerals were stenciled on the sides of the container, which was roughly the size of a traditional footlocker. On the top of the box were smaller letters and numbers, all in a coded jumble beneath a torn red, white, and blue decal of the American flag.
These boxes are never the same twice. What's in it?
JB recognized the style of standard military-issue container from his many searches of redoubt supply rooms. The boxes could be used for anything from drab camouflage clothing to the near-inedible delight of rations of self-heat cuisine. However, more often than not, the boxes were also dumps for ammunition, grenades, or guns.
You're so smart, you tell me.
Could be nothing but an empty box, Carter. I've seen the package 1,000 times before, but the present inside is usually long gone.
Not this time, Dix. This time I've got party favors for everybody.
Carter lifted the lid with a proud flourish. JB and Mildred both leaned over and peered down inside.
Good
Dark
Lord!
Night!
Carter reached inside and removed a silver and red concussion grenade. He tossed it lightly in the air over to JB, who calmly reached down his right hand and caught the lethal egg before it could hit the ground.
No need to worry, Dr. Wyeth. These things can't hurt anyone until they're armed.
Old as those grins are, they could blow right in our faces. I don't like taking chances.
JB returned the explosive device to the metal and wire rack in the bottom of the steel container.
Well, I count 8. 2 burners, 1 concussion, 1 frag, and 4 high X. Decent mix. Timers seem to be tight and clean. The outsides don't look too badly corroded either. Last batch of grins we found, they were leaking like hell.
I remember. Dean knocked the box over, and the entire lot nearly went off in our faces. Did a 10-second run to safety and 9 seconds flat to outrun the timers.
This time we're keeping the kid out of the grins.
Grab one into the box, Dix. I'll carry the other. We'll divvy up the grins back at the commune. Sean and Ryan will probably want to decide which ones we're going to use.
JB already knew that Ryan would say to take them all. The rumble of the wag that they had been warned about shook the armorer from his memories. The wag was a familiar sight to both Ryan and JB. From the flat-backed rear access hatch to the bullet-shaped blunt nose and angled headlights, the vehicle was a near twin of the type they had recently liberated from a cache found inside an underground complex in Dulce, New Mexico. The primary difference was that the earlier wag had been factory new, with barely 100 miles logged on the odometer. It had been fully loaded, too, with a barricade remover, a Watson Olsen spotlight, and a twin speaker-mounted public address system. There were no extras on the wag now approaching their hiding place, and the wag was in poor condition. The paint was nearly gone along the sides in front, revealing the thick armor plating that secured the passengers within safely. One side rack of headlights was shattered, a reminder of a past collision.
Hotspur Hussar armored Land Rover. Seen better days. I'd say she's going about 30 miles per hour. Driver will have to slow up at the curve. I'd take the shot then.
Ryan nodded and raised the 6-hour. Originally, Mildred had been the one chosen to make the shot, until Shauna had stressed the need for silence for her plan to work. Mildred's aim with the checked target revolver was uncanny, but the gun was explosively loud. Ryan had offered the 6-hour to her, but she declined. It wasn't that complicated a shot, and Ryan's familiarity with his own gun would make him the logical shooter. The plan was indeed a simple one. Take out one of the Land Rover's enormous rubber tires and make the men inside believe they were the unfortunate recipients of a blowout. With luck, they would all leave the wag to change the tire, eliminating the need for a firefight that would probably end up with casualties and a damaged, possibly inoperable wag. Ryan wanted the wag intact. He wanted the way inside to Poseidon. As the wag rumbled past, Ryan took careful aim between the armored flanges, protecting the rear right wheel well.
Hope they brought a spare.
Hell of a good time to bring that up, Shauna.
Here they come. Side door sliding back.
2 SEC men, their rifles down, stepped out of the wag onto the packed dirt and gravel of the road. They were dressed in identical mirrored sunglasses, steel blue helmets, and what appeared to be old-style bulky exterior bulletproof vests.
What's with the uniforms?
SEC teams that go off the base usually suit up. Intimidation and safety.
No chest shots. Aim for the faces.
Well, what do you think? Hit them now?
I think we should let them go about their business of changing the tire.
Sure you want to wait that long, Ryan? What if they find the bullet?
They won't. Not unless they're looking, and not until they have the wag jacked up. I figure you might as well let them do the work for us. Once the wag is off the ground, we'll introduce ourselves. No way they can get rolling again before they put on the spare.
How many you think are inside?
Don't know. Those Land Rovers are big bastards. They can hold 8 men in the rear.
Not this one. That thing could seat 20 and it wouldn't matter. Poseidon keeps them lean. He's going to have ample room for the food he takes back.
Like I said last night, my guess is 4 men. That was typical standard operations back when I ran with his men. It's also the same lineup as the last 3 times Poseidon sent a transport out here by land. A driver and a passenger up front, 2 others in the back. A pair to stay alert and watch for trouble. And a pair to use their backs to help load up the booty.
So let's find out.
Ryan watched as a third man joined the duo in removing the blown tire.
But whatever you do, don't let them get back inside the wag.
As planned, Shauna left her weapon behind and made her way down to a far end of the ditch. Far enough down to where it would appear she had merely been walking down the road and come upon the wag's unfortunate predicament. Just an innocent encounter with a pedestrian. Shauna stepped into the open and jauntily walked toward the downed Land Rover.
Hey, need a hand?
Mildred noted that the woman had unzipped the front of her jumpsuit even more than usual.
She's gonna fall right out of that thing if she's not careful.
So much the better.
Get ready.
2 of the men whirled toward Shauna with their AK-47s held ready when she spoke. The third man outside of the Land Rover was occupied with a jack. The leader, a veteran SEC man named Martin, relaxed when he recognized Shauna. He knew from experience that she wasn't there to cause any trouble. Still, it was odd for the commune leader to be showing up so far down the road from the settlement. And why was she alone? Ryan quickly made his way around the back to the open side door of the wag and shoved his Sig Sauer inside, aiming at the driver.
Your pals are dead. You're next unless you want to come out of that seat quietly.
The driver raised his hands.
Good. I hate cleaning up brains off a windshield.
The spare was then placed on the wag without fanfare by the captured driver, under Ryan's close supervision. JB and Carter dragged the bodies into the former hiding place in the ditch while Ryan questioned the driver.
What's your name?
Edgerton, sir.
You enlisted or Merc?
Edgerton Ray, sir. Enlisted man.
Great.
A spare helmet and pair of sunglasses had been discovered in a storage drawer inside the wag. Ryan would wear the outfit and ride shotgun with the surviving member of the SEC squad, while JB, Mildred, and Carter hid in the back. Once they were on the base, the second part of the operation would be carried out with the grins and any other explosives they could scrounge up on site. Carter, Mildred, and JB would play delivery boys. Ryan and Shauna were going in search of Poseidon. But Ryan had one final stop to take care of first.
I'm going with you, Dad!
No, Dean, you're not.
I'm not a kid anymore! You need me!
I need you right here with Doc. He's still too weak to go off into a firefight. Somebody has to stay with him.
Doc can take care of himself!
Usually that's true, but not this time. Besides, he needs somebody to watch his back.
But, Dad!
Enough, Dean! One of Traitor's rules was to never split your forces. If you've only got half your men, you've only got half your power, he'd say. Of course, now. The older I'm getting, the less inclined I am to always agree with everything Traitor told me. We've already lost 2 people to this Poseidon. Jack was like a son to me in many ways. And Christy was my soulmate. I'll be damned if I'll risk losing another loved one to that bastard.
Jack was my friend, too! And I loved Christy!
I know, son. Believe me, I understand. But I'm not asking you to stay here as a father. I'm telling you to stay as a leader. You don't want to be treated like a kid? Fine. Then act like a man and do what I tell you.
Not fair!
Life seldom is.
How long before you're back?
Not sure. No way of knowing. Half day there on the wag, according to Carter. Half day back if the wag's still running after we get inside the base. I'd say we'll be back here in a couple of days, unless something goes bad wrong. If the plan goes south on us, then I guess it doesn't matter.
2 days, Dad. 2 days, and then I'm coming after you. Even if I have to carry Doc on my shoulders.
Should be long enough. 2 days, then.
Dean was shocked into silence. He'd never imagined his father would agree to letting him come out in search of the advance party, even with a wait of 48 hours. Ryan held up a hand, gave a little wave to his son, and walked out of the tent. Before Dean could also exit, Ryan stepped back inside.
Dean?
Yeah, Dad?
If you do end up carrying Doc around, remember, he's a lot heavier than he looks.
I won't forget.
What Dean didn't know was that Ryan would have done exactly the same thing at Dean's age. He also knew that the boy wouldn't be able to wait any longer than 2 days, which was fine. In 2 days' time, Admiral Poseidon would be a dead man, and his so-called empire would be a ruin, even if Ryan had to die himself in the process.